We return this evening to the book of Esther, Esther chapter 7, we'll pick up the last verse of chapter 6 and read through the chapter. Chapter 7 will be our text. Esther 6, verse 14. And while they were yet talking with him, that's Haman's wife, Zeresh, and his friends, predicting that Haman was going to fall. And while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared. So this is sometime during the day. It takes quite a long time for dignitaries to get ready for such a banquet as that. They came and brought him to get ready for the banquet that night. So the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, "What is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? And it shall be performed even to half of the kingdom." Then Esther the queen answered and said, "If I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage." Then the king Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, "Who is he, where is he, that durst presume in his heart to do so?" And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. And Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. Then said the king, "Will he force the queen also before me in the house?" As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, "Behold also the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him thereon." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. Beloved of God, in Esther chapter 7, we have the second banquet and the second and final meeting of the big three, King Ahasuerus, his second in command, Haman, and the queen, Esther. As these three come into this banquet this night, we observe that all three have a certain uncertainty about this banquet. Esther comes very uncertain about how Ahasuerus is going to respond now that she finally has to make her grand request for her own life and the life of the Jews. Ahasuerus comes into the banquet with uncertainty. He's uncertain about what it is Esther is going to request. He's been wondering that for some time now. Haman also comes to the banquet with uncertainty. He didn't come to the first one with uncertainty, but with this one he does. because of what had happened earlier in that day, having to exalt Mordecai at the request of the king. He comes with uncertainty because after doing that, he had gone to his wife and to his friends, told them, covered his face in shame. And his wife and friends have responded to him, if this is what's happened, if God has done this, and he's intervening here for his people, the Jews, then it's only going to continue. You're going to fall. So he's uncertain. He didn't even have time to think about that, really. The king's helpers came and got him, we read in verse 14 of chapter 6, right from there, and brought him to get ready for the banquet. That's what's on his mind as he comes. He's uncertain about what's going to happen. There's only one in this story who is uncertain, who is not uncertain, rather, about this banquet, and that is God himself, who is so evidently there in all of this book, and who is overseeing everything, and who has arranged for this meeting. Besides the observation that these three come with a certain uncertainty, we also observe that as these three come into this banquet, all three of them are ignorant of certain things. The three people, one knows this, the other doesn't know that. One knows this, and they bring ignorance as well as uncertainty. You have to remember that though we, observing in the reading of this book, know the whole big picture, these don't. They don't know everything. Esther, for example, has no idea that Haman has built a gallows upon which to hang Mordecai, and has no idea that Haman had come to Ahasuerus that very morning to ask the king to be allowed to hang Mordecai on that gallows. Esther has no idea everything that's happened through the previous night, how God himself kept the king awake through the night, and how the king was looking for a boring book to read to put him back to sleep, and how in God's providence the servants came up with the Chronicles of the Empire from 5 years ago and just happened to turn to the part where Mordecai had uncovered a plot against the king's life. Esther has no idea that any of this has happened. She has no idea even that at the moment when Haman came in to ask to kill Mordecai, that the king actually instead called Haman to exalt Mordecai. And Esther has no idea through all of that in the night that God was preparing for the request that she must make now at this second banquet. That the king realizes that this Mordecai who saved his life is a Jew. Esther has uncertainty, and Esther has ignorance. Ahasuerus has ignorance. He has no idea that his queen is a Jew. And he has no idea about Haman, that the reason why Haman wanted this law to be passed to exterminate the Jews was more than just thinking that it would help out King Ahasuerus, but that there was a personal vendetta and there was a national hatred of the Amalekites for the Jews. Haman has ignorance. Haman has no idea that the law that he wanted passed to kill all the Jews included this woman that has now invited him to this banquet, the queen, Esther. It's no idea that Esther is a Jew. And Haman has no idea that Esther knows that he's the one who wanted to get this law passed, and not just for the sake of the empire, Persia, but for his own personal vendetta and hatred of the Jews, the seed of the serpent versus the seed of the woman. There's these people here, and they know certain things, and other ones don't know other things. And here they come now at this banquet this night, and everything's going to come out. But just like there's only one with no uncertainty, there's only one with no ignorance, who has himself in his providence arranged for this meeting, and arranged for this meeting in precisely this way so that this person knows this and this person doesn't, so that it would all come out here and work for the saving of his church. Jehovah, God over all. The major theme of the book of Esther is that sovereign providence of God, that all-determining and all-accomplishing providence that overrules all history unto his kingdom and covenant. And there's been times, well, really every sermon in this book, it's come up, but there's been times where the book itself has led us to focus upon that theme, to zero in upon that providence of God, like last time in chapter 6 with the king's sleepless night. There's other times where the book has led us to focus upon a sub-theme of this book, the responsibility. Responsibility under that sovereignty. We did that in chapter 5 with Esther coming to the courtyard, stand before the king holding out his scepter. We're going to do that tonight again with the responsibility of Esther when she finally makes her request. But even as we zero in on that part, the responsibility, let's not forget the major theme that carries through in the whole book. For the timing of Esther to do this has been worked out perfectly in the plan of God. He's placed Esther in this position for such a time as this. And the outcome of this meeting, the fall of Haman, has been determined and it's been prepared for just the night before. It's the Lord's doing. And even Esther's responsible conduct and ours that we'll talk about tonight, important as it is and real as it is, is still part of that providence of God working, unfolding all of his holy will. And tonight, part of what that will unfolds is the destruction of the enemies of his church, of his Christ, and of his kingdom. The fall of Haman is the theme. Let's notice first the plot exposed. Second, a terrifying judgment. Third, let's ask the question, who will take our gallows? The fall of Haman, the plot exposed, terrifying judgment, and who will take our gallows? You have to remember, as Esther now comes in to expose the plot of Haman, that she's coming before a very fickle and selfish and violent man in Ahasuerus, king of Persia. We've discovered that in the book itself already as we've gone through how quickly Ahasuerus turned when he got angry. Quickly he turned on Vashti, banished her, divorced her. We've seen the violent and callous nature of this king when we saw how little he even cared about the mass genocide of a whole people group in his empire. What's that, Haman? 10,000 talents of silver for my coffers? Fine, go kill them all. I don't even need to know who they are. I add one more from the history books that present this same consistent image of this king. There was one time a wealthy man in the empire named Pythias gave a massive amount of money for Ahasuerus' campaign, military campaign against the Greeks that we talked about in chapter 1 and 2. For giving all of that money to Ahasuerus to fight his campaign against the Greeks, Pythias thought it wasn't unreasonable to ask Ahasuerus to then make it so that his own son, Pythias' own son, wouldn't have to fight. He could just stay out of the battle. When Ahasuerus heard that request, he went over to Pythias' house, took his son, and cut him into two pieces, right there. And then he divided the two pieces of the boy on either side of a road, and he commanded his entire army to pass through it, and everyone to look so that they know this is what happens to anybody who thinks that they won't fight in my army. This is the man that Esther has to come before now. Try to divide a wedge between him and his Vice President Haman. Seek somehow his own self-interest to save her life, the life of the people. And remember that the king has lost interest in her very quickly. And she had said, for 30 days he hasn't even called to me to talk to me or anything. This is why Esther has been so careful. And why she's careful still. Remember that she knew the king was intrigued. He held out the scepter to her. Why would this woman risk her life? What is she requesting of me? And Esther saw that and knew that, and so she thought to build that up a little bit before she let her request known, get some intrigue going with this king. He's lost interest in her. So she said, not now. Come to a banquet and I'll tell you. And then he comes to the banquet. She says, not now, one more time. Tomorrow night, come to one more banquet and I'll tell you. And Ahasuerus was intrigued at both of those banquets. It's he who goes after her. Tell me, what is your request? What is it? He's dying to know. It's possible that that's what kept him up all night the night before. But now the time has come. And Esther can delay no longer. And she must expose the plot of Haman against her and the Jews. Notice three things about how she does it. First, notice the humility, carefulness. The humility and carefulness. Beginning right away in verse 3, then Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. Qualifications first. If I have found favor in thy sight, O king, if it pleases you, O king, and maybe some of that is formality, language of the court. But she would have been tempted in anger and frustration and sorrow and scared to just come and blurt it out. What have you done? You made a law and it's going to kill me. Your own queen. But she's careful and humble and wise. She takes the approach almost of Nathan the prophet as he comes to confront David. Remember how Nathan the prophet first got David's sense of anger and justice riled up so that David was angry about this. And then Nathan said, now here's the issue. It has something to do with you. It's really what Esther does here. Verse 4, for we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. She doesn't say, you've sold us into... But something horrible has happened. We've been sold in the passive, and she doesn't even say anything about Haman at this point. We've been sold. Me, the queen of Persia, have been sold to be destroyed, and my people. And then, sold to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. Does that sound familiar to you? She's quoting from the decree that Haman had made. Remember, Esther 3, verse 13, and the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all the Jews. Someone has sold us to be destroyed, to be killed, and to perish. Ahasuerus doesn't seem to make the connection. The law meant nothing to him. It's just sign off on it, whatever, some people are going to die. Haman for sure makes the connection and starts to tremble. So she continues. And continues again in humility. Verse 4. If we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue. If all it was is we were selling me and my people into slavery, I wouldn't have said anything. Although even then, the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. We've been sold as slaves, it'd be fine. We've lived as slaves many times before. But utter destruction as a people, I must say something, I must speak. And then with that last phrase in verse 4, she's appealing to the king's vanity. Even if we were sold into slaves, the enemy couldn't countervail the damage that would do to the king. Think about this, king. Your own queen, the queen of Persia, being sold as a slave, and now this is worse, to be killed. What would that do to your reputation as a king? She knows she can't just appeal to some love between him and her, but some vanity in him. This damages you and your reputation. Now Ahasuerus is angry. Now he's upset. So verse 5, he bursts. Who is he? Who's done this? And where is he that dares presume in his heart to do this? Who would dare to do this to the queen of Persia, my queen? Wouldn't matter if that queen was Esther. It wouldn't matter if it was Vashti or anyone else. It's the fact that it's the queen of Persia, his queen, that gets him mad. This is treachery. This is treason. This is an attack on the empire you're telling me about. Who is this? Who's done this? Let me at him. And so now, and this is the second thing we notice about how she does it. When the time is right, she comes out with it forthright. Doesn't beat around the bush. Exposes plot against the people of God. Verse 6. And Esther said, "The adversary and the enemy," no doubt pointing, "is this wicked Haman." The king is shocked. The king is angry. He's shocked. He's confused. He doesn't know exactly what's going on. And so he gets up and goes out to the garden to walk a few laps and try to figure everything out. He has to think about all of this. And once he makes all the connections now in his mind, he also has to figure a way out of this. He can't do nothing. He can't just let his queen be killed on the basis of a law that he himself passed. And how does he get Haman killed? Everybody in the empire thinks Haman has nothing to do with this. It was his signet ring on that law. It's his law. How could he kill Haman for his law that he passed? Well, let's leave him out in the garden to think about it for a little bit and notice the third thing about how Esther exposes the plot against her and the people of God. The first thing was her humility, carefulness. The second, the time is right, the forthrightness about what it was. And the third is now to do this. She's willing to identify herself as a Jew with the people of God. Whether she does that in her heart, I leave to your judgment. And if you don't want to make the judgment, as I don't, we'll leave it for heaven to know. But this is the first time that she publicly expresses that she is a Jew. This is the first time the king is finding out that he's married a Jew. Verse 4, "For we are sold, I and my people." I and my people, I'm a part of this people, these Jews that this law is against, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to cause to perish. She's telling the king, "I have hid this from you for over 5 years. I have kept it quiet from you. And the whole time I've compromised every single last one of the laws of Jehovah God. I haven't done a single one of them. I've lived as a Persian. I haven't celebrated the feasts, nothing. But I'm a Jew, and these people are my people. And if this law stands, I die too." God may have you in just the right position to expose a plot against his people. Maybe even now. Not on the scale of this, more than likely, and from different points of view, perhaps, but real plots, dangerous plots, treacherous plots against his people, his church, his bride that he loves. From one point of view, quite similar to the situation here. God has had his people in positions to help expose plots against his church's physical well-being in our day and in this land. Think about laws that have been passed in this land recently, especially the big one a while ago, approving homosexual marriage. If you paid any attention after the legalizing of homosexual marriage in the United States, you would have seen many articles, not just in its sideline fringe, in main media outlets, written about how now the Christians had better watch out, be aware. For example, this from the New York Times. Quote, the author writes, if I were a conservative Christian, which I most certainly am not, this is the author of this article, if I were a conservative Christian, which I most certainly am not, I would very reasonably be fearful. Fearful that within a generation, my religious beliefs would be treated the same way as racism. End quote. Or this from the National Review, quote, lawsuits challenging church liberties are inevitable. Indeed, already the Iowa Civil Rights Commission has declared that prohibitions against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity only sometimes applies to churches. In other words, the religious liberty of the church to preach its conviction and the protection of the law for that, only sometimes does that apply to churches with regard to speaking about homosexuality in their pulpits. And then it continues, and it has stated that, quote, a church service open to the public is not a bona fide religious purpose that would protect them from this law. A church service, preaching, does not necessarily fall under religious freedom anymore. And since then, God has put lawyers. He's put lawyers in our churches, had them in certain positions. This past year, our synod called upon them to start making statements that could perhaps prevent legal action against us and other lawyers too. Had them in that position for such a time as this. If they want to get us, they're going to get us. There's no doubt about that. But perhaps God will use them in their positions that he has put them, that the church may live a quiet and peaceable life for a bit longer yet. But that aside, beloved, much more importantly than that, he will use his people, he'll use you to expose the plots of the evil one against his church spiritually. Parents, he has put you in position to expose plots against his people, his little lambs under your care. Plots against them, devious, treacherous plots that aim at the destruction of their soul and eventually the entire church of Jesus Christ. And when you expose them, when you expose those plots to your little ones and you say, this is the devil, this is the enemies of God's people who are behind this entertainment industry, the movies and the media of this age. And when you say that and expose that to them, you are Esther in Esther chapter 6. You are exposing the plots of the evil one to destroy the church of Jesus Christ. You're in position. Nobody else is. You're in position to do that. With how many other things that attack their souls, you speak, you expose the plots against them. Sometimes this has to happen in a home, even in a marriage. A husband has to expose a plot of the evil one that he sees against his wife, or a wife exposes a plot of the evil one against her husband, caught up in some sin or some pattern of sin. You expose the plot. This is hurting you. The times when church members must do that with each other and say carefully, "This is going on. I didn't want to see it. I don't want to know about this. But I see it, and I know it, and I can't unknow it. And it's the evil one leading you down a wrong road, and it's hurting you and your family. You don't even see it. I must expose this plot before you and show you what it is." Elders in the church, you're in position. By God himself placed into position to expose plots against the body of Jesus Christ, and there are many. When you come to a young person who's influenced by errant doctrine that will hurt their soul, as a shepherd of Jesus Christ, you love them. You expose it to them and you say, "You don't even see the implications of this. You probably should, because you've been through catechism for how many years, but you don't seem to. But I'm telling you, there's devilishness behind this. Or a lifestyle, or you're walking in a way of sin, and you don't seem to realize what this is, what this is going to do to you. You are exposing plots of the evil one against his beloved bride. And you're in position. Do it. Do it." The ministers who preach the word and call out unbiblical lifestyle, call out false doctrine because it hurts the flock, do so, exposing the plots of the evil one to hurt the bride of Jesus Christ. Brethren, James 5, "If any of you do err from the truth and one convert him, let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins." And all God's people are called to expose these plots. They must understand that they're placed in the kingdom and in that particular place where they're aware of it for such a time as this. When God's people do that, especially with each other, but always, they ought to follow the manner of Esther, her general approach. First of all, with an evident humility, approaching the brother or sister in the knowledge of my own sins, willing to be shown wrong if I'm wrong about this. What I see really isn't actually the way that it is, and expressing that, and that kind of humility. Exposing something that is false, a doctrine or a lifestyle, not out of the delight of being able to really ream them a new one, but because the church is under attack, and of love for the sheep and humility, knowing that I am liable to such attack myself. That first, with that humility. And then second, when the time is right, when you're sure. For the fourth, right declaration, no beating around the bush, calling it what it is. That wicked Haman, this thing is evil. This isn't an issue of, well, maybe. This thing is evil. Turn away. And then third, knowing that doing so is publicly joining yourself to the cause of God and the people of God in doing it, and saying that matters to me more than if this person ultimately gets offended at me. Though I come with humility, if I come with pride, then they have every right to be offended at me. But though I come with humility and they're still offended, I take my side with God and his cause and his people publicly for the sake of his name and the good of his bride. Maybe somebody here right now, maybe you, hearing this are thinking, I need to go home and have a conversation with my teenager, my college student, because I've had to do this and I haven't done it. A conversation with family member, maybe extended family member. Expose the plot that is against them. For someone in the church, expose the plot that is against them, for it's destroying them, and I know it, and I see it. The time has come. I've been put in this position. I don't want to. In humility, I'll do it. And when you do, by the same grace that gives you to do it, may the enemy that seeks to hurt the church of God fall at your and their feet, as Haman fell before Esther. From the moment that Esther had said, we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed and caused to perish, Haman has been shaking in his boots. And no doubt he's thinking about what his wife had told him just a couple of hours earlier, that he's going to fall. But now, especially when Ahasuerus gets up piping hot and heads out to the palace garden, Haman knows he's in deep trouble. Maybe it crossed his mind for a moment to go follow Ahasuerus out there into the garden and to plead for his life from Ahasuerus. But in the second moment, he knows what you and I know. When this man gets mad, you don't want to be anywhere around him. And so instead, he goes to Esther and pleads for his life from her. Verse 7. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. And Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther, the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. And as he's making request for his life from the queen, finally he falls down. He falls down on his knees, pleading and weeping for his life. And he drapes himself across Esther's legs as she lies reclined on a couch. That's how they even ate. Reclined like that, he drapes himself over her, the bottom part of her body. Please, please. And at just that moment, Ahasuerus comes back again. The providence of God. Just that moment, it happens to be, and Ahasuerus sees Haman over the bottom part of his wife. There's a law in Persia that said no males may come within 7 steps of any woman of the court, whether that woman was one of the concubines of the king or the queen herself. But Haman has forgotten all of that as he fears for his life, and Ahasuerus comes in and sees him. In verse 8, then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. Then said the king, will he force the queen also before me in the house? The Hebrew word means to attack, subdue, do violence to. He wanted to make a decree against the Jews. Now that he knows that the queen is a Jew and that this queen has exposed his plot, is he going to attack her right here before me? The soldiers were lined around the outside of the room. Don't need any more prompting. They come, put a black cloth over Haman's head, which of course is what you do to those you're about to execute. And then interestingly, Harbona, one of the 7 eunuchs that attends the king, pipes up. Behold, also, verse 9, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, the Mordecai who spoke good for the king, who saved his life. Those gallows stand in the house of Haman. The word gallows makes you think of a rope and hanging a noose around the neck, but that's not it. The Hebrew word is, there is no English word that really can translate it, but the idea is a tree upon which you expose the bodies of criminals, as in by a crucifixion. Hang him, said the king. Hang him on his own gallows. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And then was the king's wrath pacified. How swift. How swift and how exacting is the justice of God. For his glory is not found only in the salvation of his church, but in the judgment of his enemies, in the saving of his church. So much has happened in the last few chapters that you might forget that it's only been 24 hours since Haman was on top of the world. It was just one day ago, the first banquet, that he came home bragging about how great everything was for him, all of his wealth and his position, and now the queen has invited me to this banquet and to another one, yet, and in lightning speed, less than 24 hours, God has chopped him down to destruction. How swift is the judgment of God, and how exacting, pure justice, poetic justice on his own gallows, but pure justice, void of mercy. Haman got precisely what he deserved. Proverbs 26, verse 27. Whoso diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it shall return upon him. And for all men are against Christ and his church, the apple of his eye. How swift and exacting is the justice of God. One moment, everything is fine. Carry on ignoring the testimony of the conscience and the reality that awaits. And so swiftly, in a moment, it all ends, and I'm standing before God, and man meets his maker. This is why we have to be ready for the life to come, how swift it is. It comes more swiftly than you think. How many people say, where did the years go? Where has the time gone? I was young and now I'm old. Don't ignore it, young people. Teach us, O God, to number our days and to apply our hearts unto wisdom. Are you ready to meet your God? That day, apart from Christ, outside of Christ, the justice of God falls with exacting sharpness. Man gets only what he deserves, pure, strict justice. How dreadful. Infinite punishment for infinite sin against an infinite God. But oh, how sin blinds to this. Oh, how sin makes men not worry about it, not think about it, not take it into consideration. How it makes men think that they're in control of the situation. Everything is fine. Haman thought he was in total control, but his control was an illusion. He loved power. He loved control. He loved the praise of men at his control. He loved the thrill that it was of taking the king's ring and stamping it in that wax. And just with that, thousands upon thousands of people must die. He had all power, but his control was an illusion. And in one night, because a king couldn't sleep, it all unravels before him, and he can't stop it from unraveling until he is undone. And when he sees it in verse 6, he's scared, he's terrified. And Haman was afraid before the king and the queen, but it's like a train wreck that it's going to happen now, but I can't stop it. Sin appeared to give Haman what he wanted. It appeared to give him joy. It appeared to give him safety. It blinded him to reality. He built his gallows in pride, thinking his revenge, his vengeance, satisfied, would be what brought him happiness and peace in his life. Every desire fulfilled, and my power to accomplish that, and my control over all things to prevent the consequences of it. So blinding and deceptive is sin. And the end comes. swiftly. The Antichrist too, who Haman pictures, shall fall, beloved, and fall swiftly. Blinded by his own pride, he seeks to take the place of God. He builds himself up, calls himself as though he was God. He exalts pleasure in everything that's against God's holy law and seeks the destruction of the people of God that would be against that. And he thinks with his power he will overcome any possible consequence that could happen upon him. God's judgment will bring him down to swiftly. And all who in their heart are themselves anti-Christ. All men by nature that end up here, beloved, like Haman, build their own gallows. Our sin, all of our life long, we heap up, build our own gallows. When the justice of God falls, there's no one to blame but ourselves. Man falls according as God's providence ordained, said Calvin, but he always falls by his own fault. But have not you built your own gallows too? And have not I built my own gallows too? By my sin, you by your sin? It's not only Haman in Esther chapter 7 who deserved to die, but it's Esther too who deserved to die. The law is still in place. And not only that, for the past 5 years she has lied to the king. Surely that's deserving of death if she would get strict justice. But how much more you and I before Almighty God? It's not only the Hamans of this world, beloved, who build their own gallows. It's you and me with the sin that we heap up against this justice of God. Hey, we deserve justice and no mercy. How many times have you, like Esther, hid who you were because you thought it'd go better for you if you just held back that you were a servant of God in Jesus Christ, that you were a part of his people? How about you? Have you ever broken his law in order to fit in with the crowd like Esther did all those years? Or what about Haman? Have you ever been deluded, deceived by sin as Haman was? Thought that your own power, your position, maybe your money, your influence, your sense of control over your own life, that would get you away with it. No one will see. No one will know. I've got this. I got this situation wrapped up around my hands. But deep down, you know that the God of heaven sees. You've ever thought like Haman that here in this pleasure will be found peace. In this vengeance will be found peace. You've built your own gallows with your own hand and I with mine. And there's the glory of the gospel. And mercy takes justice. And the Lord Jesus Christ, God himself, very God of very God, comes down and identifies himself with his people. It says in a greater way than Esther ever did, I and my people. Takes upon himself their humanity, comes to live with them, among them in the dirt and filth of their life, and so identifies with them that he takes upon himself their sins and the justice that is due to them for them, so that though by their sins they build their own gallows too, he mounts that cross and takes it for himself, exposes himself upon it as though he was the criminal who has done this. so that there is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus, but mercy, floods of never-ending mercy. May truth break through all lies and deception. May your identity be found in Him, this Christ, and in Him alone. Whether that's in your closet, or nobody sees, or publicly before all the world. And if that's in times when you know, I have to stand up and expose the plot of the evil one. God has put me in this place, this time to do so, to join myself, the people of God. And may mercy, life, and hope be yours. Amen. Father, bless thy word to our hearts and strengthen us by it. In Jesus' name, amen.